Welcome back to another episode of the Alchemist Lounge. As always, I'm your host, Alex Atwood, and today we have a special treat. So if you've ever tuned into NPR, you might have been graced by the insightful conversations on Jazzed About Work. Well, our guest today is Beverly Jones. And Beverly is the mastermind behind that show. Bev has been the go-to guru for countless people looking for the secret sauce around workplace happiness. And she helps them get all jazzed up and get to a place where they can actually experience workplace happiness and really enjoy what they do for a living. And I always say, if you're not enjoying it, then you should be doing something else, because enjoyment is just so important in life. So Bev is an attorney, she's an executive coach, she's a podcast host, and so much more. Her journey is a testament to the alchemy of reinvention. And I've had the pleasure of being a guest on her podcast, and now it's time to turn the tables. So let's dive right in and learn more about the incredible Beverly Jones. Bev, I'm so thrilled to have you light up the lounge today.
Well, I'm really excited to be here. I love your attitude and I love transformation, and I feel like we're going to have some fun here.
Absolutely. We're going to have a great conversation today. So tell me about your journey. I mean, you span law, coaching, you know, radio, podcasting. Where did the journey begin?
Well, it reveals a lot about my age, which I don't mind, but I have to go back even further than that. When I was an undergraduate at Ohio University, I was kind of the campus feminist. I had been a journalism student, and I suddenly realized that newspapers were only hiring women to work on the cooking page and the woman's section, and there are all kinds of opportunities closed. I don't know why I didn't realize it earlier, but when it hit me, I was just overwhelmed by how ridiculous that is. So I decided I was going to do something every day. I couldn't really change things, but if I could do something every day and support the idea that women should have equal opportunities, at least I'd feel better about it. So I started that as an undergraduate, and I stayed on campus for a while. I became the first woman at the MBA program, but I had radio. So I was able to keep talking. And I started speaking, and, you know, I just made a total nuisance of myself. And finally, the president of the university said, "Bev, it's time to put your money where your mouth is. I hear you talking all the time. Everybody hears you talking all the time, but you need some data behind it. You studied journalism. I'm going to hire you to spend a year doing a report on the status of women at Ohio University, and come back to me in a year. You're going to be my assistant. You're going to have an office, you know, in the executive suites, but you've got to prove that things are wrong and they should be changed." So for a year, while I was still working a little bit at the radio station and still working on my MBA, I started writing a report. And every day, again, a little bit at a time, I tried to do something every day. I interviewed women from across campus, from the cleaners in the dorms who got paid 2/3 of what the men's cleaners in the dorms got, to the highest ranking women and all the other people around them. And I came up with, I think 21 recommendations for change. And by that time, a year later, Title IX was coming. So at the age, I think, of 25, I was hired to be assistant to the president, responsible for opening doors for women and developing ways to get them into engineering and business and architecture and all the places that had no women. And so that's when I got interested in coaching and careers and how things changed. And I must tell you, I knew nothing. I mean, I knew nothing about organizations. The report was okay because I knew how to ask questions as a journalism student. It was a long time before I understand leadership's ruling about asking questions. But Anyway, that's where I got started in understanding that transformation was possible, because without any knowledge, I just kept talking with people and we kept inventing things. We invented programs. We opened the door. And then I went off to law school to try a new path myself. So that's how I started.
Wow. So let me understand. So it started out with journalism, learning to ask open-ended questions, learning to explore, becoming curious.
Exactly.
But really with a focus, a purpose of being able to transform things, transform the state of the way women were being represented throughout that campus. So what happened? What was the culmination of that? Did anything happen based on the report that you delivered? Was there some sort of spark that you saw happen at OU after that?
Yes. What happened was, I wasn't really asked to make recommendations, but I made 21 recommendations. And the president at the time was a former law school dean. He was a lawyer. And so I tried to talk about the laws that did exist then. And I made very specific recommendations, like women should be able to be in athletics. At that point, there are millions of dollars spent on intercollegiate athletics for men. At Ohio University, women had 3,000. That was the total budget. And that was like that all across America. All programs should open. We needed ways to get women into administration. My very favorite one, because it was such a good talking point, is that women should be allowed to march in the marching band. Mm. At the time, the band was called 110 Marching Men, and the feeling was that women weren't capable of marching around with those big, strong men. So that was before Title IX. There weren't many people around doing the same thing. And for me, it was an opportunity to really invent some new things, and the president accepted them. And so the next few years, I was working on programs to eliminate all the things we made up just out of nothing, and working with lots of people to turn it into real change.
Mm, wow. And so that then sparked an interest in law, which I find fascinating, because what a meaty topic and what a relevant topic to be working on with such purpose. So what had you spark the interest in law, and why the transition to go study law?
Well, of course, what I did was I looked at the law as it was, and I looked at the law as it should be. And so I became very interested, and I went to law school with the idea that that's the kind of law I was going to do. I was going to look at equality in education, equality in employment, all kinds of things. But by the time I finally got to Georgetown Law School, I felt kind of exhausted from all those things. I'd been doing it too long. I wanted to try something brand new. And, you know, I found I like to change careers every once in a while. So I went off to the Securities and Exchange Commission for my first job. And then I went to law firms, and I ended up doing alternative energy because that was another change that was about to happen. And I really like getting in when things are changing. So that was my next career. And there I became an executive with a big company and kind of flew around the country testifying before utility commissions about the importance of dispersed generation and things like that at a time when nobody was interested in those things.
Wow, that is fascinating. So you've pursued something, some sort of, I hate to say, keep using the word purpose, but it really is something that you've just kind of went after. And I'm curious, when you switched from journalism to law, did you continue any thread in journalism? Did you do any sort of work around podcasts or radio, or have any of those conversations that you were having back at the university?
In the early days of practicing law, I made a really dumb decision, and I decided that I want to be just like the boys. I wanted to figure out how law firms work, and of course, law firms are very entrepreneurial, so that was good. I learned about how to get my own clients and things like that. But I just tried to do all the things that they did. And since I couldn't play golf and, you know, I wasn't a big drinker, you know, some of the ways of marketing didn't work for me. But it took me a while to figure out that I had to do my own thing. And so the way I was able to get clients and develop opportunities was writing. And I just went back to writing. And so every transition I've made, I've done some kind of writing about it. And it's how I figure things out in my own head. And it's how I've been able to make a transition, because I kind of start the writing before I really know anything, and I write myself into the development of some kind of expertise.
So the writing continued even through the career transitions.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. I was writing about, you know, in journals and things like that about alternative energy. Mm. But what I found is that no matter what job I had, what I really am fascinated about is how people can change their own lives, how they can change the career, and how you helped them do that. So I started that back in the university, and I, you know, when I was lobbying Congress, I was at a party one day on the Hill, and the chief of staff for a big committee called me over and said, "Bev, I have a staff member here. She's new. I really want you to talk to her." And I thought, wow, I finally made it as a lobbyist, because nobody ever wanted to talk to an alternative energy lobbyist. And I thought, I'm finally there. And he took me over and introduced me. And then he said to this young woman, "I want you to be lobbied by Bev, because, you know, it's like going through analysis. It's like you have your own psychiatrist." And I thought, oh, wow, you know, maybe I am in the wrong field. But, you know, every place I've ever been, I've always liked getting to know the people and hearing what they were trying to do and trying to understand their mission and seeing if there's anything I could do that would help them at the same time we work toward whatever mission we were working toward.
Right. It's that sort of core of being a journalist, being curious, listening, and actually, you know, hearing what's behind necessarily, you know, the words and seeing what is actually needed. You know, what's interesting is, when we talk about, you know, different careers, different jobs, I read something not too long ago that compared a job to a career to a calling. And basically what it was that a job is a way to make money. A career is central to your identity and your sense of progress. And a calling is something beyond yourself. And I remember speaking with someone who was putting that reference towards folks that were part of the cleaning crew of a hospital, and saying that they were able to conduct interviews and understand that some of the employees really saw this as a way to make ends meet. Some of the other employees really wanted to move up and get certified and, you know, have a, you know, get more distinguished, right? You know, perhaps becoming a manager or perhaps getting some sort of certification. And then there was those that really felt that cleaning and creating a sanitized and healthy atmosphere, an environment where people were in need and were sick, doing that was something that was beyond themselves. And I found that was very, very interesting. In your time, in all of your different careers, have you found any sort of similar thread to what I just described?
Yes, I state it a little differently, but I always have it in mind when I'm working with coaching clients. In my own head, I call it the engagement triangle, that three things are really important if you're going to enjoy and get a lot from what you do in your working hours. One thing is mission. And everybody does better if they have a mission. Now, if they have a very tedious, low-level job that they hate, the mission can be putting their kids through college or going to graduate school themselves. But you have to have something that you believe in, whether it's the mission of the organization or your own mission that you create because you want to do things well. And then, speaking of doing things well, another thing is your processes, your expertise. People are happier. Work feels more like play if you're learning something, if you're developing expertise. If anytime you learn something new, it's kind of exciting and you get this jolt of energy. So kind of the expertise is one of it. And then the final one is the processes you go through. If you like what you're doing, whether it's writing or sweeping or cooking or whatever, the processes can you know, be part of the expertise. But so I put processes together with expertise. But the other thing is the people. Sometimes you think about very difficult jobs. I think working in a hospital emergency room must be so difficult, and you have some mission, but essentially it's about the people. It's the people you're saving. It's the people you're working with. So if you have people and then you have process and expertise, they're somewhere. And if you have mission, you might be driven by one thing more than another at different times, but you kind of always are, I think, trying to get a balance among those things. And if you lack any one of them, it's really hard to have a fulfilling time on the job. Mm.
You know, what's interesting is when I have conversations with leaders these days, they really have, they have a pulse on what we're talking about. I think it's more, there's more awareness around really, you know, they call it, you know, empathetic listening, understanding what's driving employees, understanding what's driving people in the workforce. Do you think that leaders can somehow create environments that can allow those who are maybe in one of the, who maybe don't have all of those components to be able to derive those components from work? Or do you think it's maybe something where that's sort of not possible, right? Like people are just sort of geared the way that they're geared based on circumstances or environment.
I think it's absolutely possible. The leaders can consciously create a culture that supports self-awareness and supports the awareness of other people and the focus on the things that matter. You know, I'm an executive coach these days, so I'm totally biased. But I think that one of the reasons why so many leaders are more self-aware and so more aware of well-being and the need for engagement and those kind of things is because coaching has changed a lot of organizational culture. When you're coaching started with very senior people, and when the leader is sitting with the coach, the coach will ask a lot of questions, sometimes pretty deep questions about what you want out of life and how you do things. And without being conscious of it necessarily, the leader will start that same style of asking other questions. And once a few people at the top get coaching, there's often a sense, gosh, we need to give it to more and more people. So I think of organizations that somehow or another, and there are a lot of different ways to do it now, have coaching, which really means learning how to listen to other people and value what other people are saying, and have everybody along the line have a chance to participate. That's changing the culture.
Yeah, I've heard that called the coach approach, where it really is an exploration and shifting from an authoritative style of leadership to a more curious style of leadership, sort of being, I've heard it called like a
When you were on my podcast, I recall you talking about how during COVID you were faced with the need to like totally change. And the first thing you did was you kind of brought people together and you listened and you you had people participate. It's exactly what you did, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that was it. We had a real spark of energy and a very collaborative and co-creative environment that we had fostered prior to COVID. And a lot of what you've described in terms of mission and growth and people, that was there, that was available in the environment. So with those key ingredients, we were able to create something that was not what we were up to at the time, totally different business. But the energy and the growth mindset and the purpose was absolutely there. And the people were there. So I think with those ingredients, I mean, you can really accomplish anything.
I agree. And I think a growth mindset is one of my favorite concepts, because it means that you believe people can do well at new things, and that people who are facing something really difficult like a pandemic have the experience and the ability to invent something new because they've done it before. So it feels like if you can create a sense of growth mindset in an organization as a leader, you really have the groundwork for innovation.
Yes. And I learned through that experience specifically that strength is absolutely sourced within vulnerability. There's a connection that's built between those that are vulnerable in leadership roles with the people that they're collaborating with and co-creating with. And those sort of connections are just not, they're just sort of not available in that authoritative sort of top-down model where people are maybe working for the mission of the leader or something that's sort of outside of something that's sort of within them that I found. So that was something for me. And thank you for bringing that up. That was a powerful example of everything you're describing in the real world in my life. And I want to transition into your life because, you know, the executive coaching, first of all, coaching has evolved so much since, you know, probably the mid 80s when, you know, the term life coach suddenly came into the public consciousness. And these days, whether it's organizational coaching, whether it's one-on-one executive coaching, there's just so many different types of coaching that are available. So I'm curious in terms of where you started, when you started your coaching career and how it's evolved along with the acceptance of coaching as a valuable way to help guide yourself and those around you.
Well, when I started coaching, I didn't really know what it was. I mean, there was much less coaching going on. I'd just seen some in my company and I hadn't been coached myself because it was just, I think, like top two people or something. But I knew what I wanted to do. I just didn't know what to call it. You know, I wanted to listen to people and help them find their way and things like that. So I got a business card that said consultant, counselor, spelled like for lawyer, and coach. Figuring I would figure it out. And then I started learning and I went back to Georgetown, which has a great coaching program.
One of the best.
And I started realizing, oh, this is so interesting because neuropsychology was just starting to be developed. And there started to be real data about how people act. And listening is certainly a key, but kind of understand how our minds and bodies and spirits, our mental strength, our physical strength, how all those things work together was very much part of the training that I took and that all good coaches are continuing to take. So it's really a bit about learning mental management and self-management and helping people find the answers to some of the things about that within themselves. My coaching is sometimes a little bit different because I was a lawyer and I led a lot of lawyers. Lawyers are not easy to lead. So I get quite a bit of opportunity from, say, the federal government to coach leaders who are leading lawyers, lawyers coaching or leading other lawyers. And coaching is very much unlike the thinking and the debate you do as a lawyer. So I've had fun with that, kind of challenging lawyers into trying a different approach. So that's one of the things that I enjoy a lot.
Mm. It's interesting. Does being an attorney inform your approach to coaching?
It helps me be aware of some of the style that lawyers are taught. Back in law school, the first year, you're taught when somebody's talking about a case in a class, in your mind, you should be thinking, what's the jurisdiction? What would I do if it were me? What am I going to say if I get called upon? You're always thinking and planning and assessing, and you learn how to think like that. And that is a great way in a courtroom. It's not a great way in life. It's not a great way in for leaders. You have to unlearn this kind of constant planning and judging and taking charge and learn to put all those things aside and listen and be authentic and vulnerable and let people talk for as long as they need to. That's a very different style of communication. And that can be a difficult transition for a bunch of lawyers because they do like to debate sometimes, but integrating into their organizations, they need to learn a broader set of communication skills sometime.
Absolutely. Leaders who are interested in taking the coach approach, and if they're not already, should invest in coaching. And if their companies aren't invested in coaching, starting with themselves, I think they'll be able to see how much different a conversation is when it is in a listening that really is exploring what's happening in the other person's world. And together, I think I've heard it referenced as a dance where the exploration uncovers within the conversation things that could be extremely powerful to the coachee or possibly the employee. Although I will say there's a caveat there that leaders are not their employees' coaches. And so myself, I've found myself in positions where there are certain, you know, protocols around work and specifically with the relationship with the employee or the relationship with a department manager or something like that. There are complexities there, but the overall empathetic approach and, you know, taking that active listening style when engaging in any conversation, I think enhances the conversation.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's a chance to connect with people in some kind of real way. And as soon as you're connected in a positive way, then you can, your minds can work together. You can invent things. You can share things. You can face difficult things together if there are not these barriers of, you know, wanting to win this conversation. If you're really listening in an open way, it makes a big difference.
Yes. There's not necessarily an objective in the conversation aside from gaining an understanding and exploring. And through that, solutions are found. It's an incredible new approach to relating to people, not just at work, but all over your life. You know, there's something interesting. You wrote in our pre-interview chat the idea that much of career happiness is up to you. I'm really curious. Can you tell me more about that?
Really, in my whole life, I've had, you know, many different jobs going back to young jobs as filing and waiting tables in a bar and things like that. They always haven't been great, but I always found myself that if I could turn it into a game, if I could turn it into an opportunity to deal with other people, if I could find a way to make this interesting, I could be happy. And so I started that way. But do I have time to tell you a little story?
Absolutely, please. I love stories.
So I learned a lot when I was, you know, trying to change Ohio University long before I knew how to do anything. And I kind of kept myself positive and upbeat every day by telling myself the mission that I'm focused on. But when I went off to law school, it was so hard. I was putting myself through law school. I'd put myself through college and the MBA. And I think I was kind of tired and there weren't that many women around, and I was starting to think I'd never get a job because I didn't know if they'd ever hire women. I mean, I was feeling sorry for myself. It was kind of the lowest point in my life. One day I heard that my brother had had a routine x-ray for a job or something, and they'd found a mass on his spine. And my sister, who was a nurse, then said that because of where it's located, if it was a cancer, that he might just have a few weeks to live. And they were rushing him to the for surgery. So for 24 hours, we didn't know what was going on. It turned out to be benign. It was fine. It was fixed in 2 days. It was not a problem, and I was so happy. And I wasn't worried about getting a job. And all of my feeling sorry for myself went away. And every day, for a few days, I felt really good. And I said, "Ooh, wait a minute. I need to look at something here." nothing has happened in my life. You know, I still am facing the same challenges. I'm still working just as hard, but I'm happy and relaxed. And nothing happened except that I changed the way I'm looking at the world. If I can do it once, I should be able to do it again. And so without having any tools, I started experimenting with that. And I think I was born as sort of a worrying, pessimistic person. I think that's sort of how I started life. And now, you know, I've learned I don't have to be that way. And I can change how I react to things. So in all of my difficulties as a young lawyer and all of those things, I just trying to be aware of my mindset, make the choices that would make me happy, find if I was lonely in some of those settings, find ways to have other friends. I just knew every day that I might have to do something, but I could, and I could enjoy every role, every day of my career. And I sort of knew nothing. I hadn't studied coaching or anything. I just did it by trial and error. And then sure enough, I started having the time to read and study and do trainings and things like that. And I have no doubt that we have tremendous control over how much we enjoy. And if you go back and read Ben Franklin's autobiography, he was the earliest one that I think I found, somebody who just took charge when he was, you know, a 13-year-old runaway kid. And he just took charge of his career and his attitude. And I think we all can kind of learn from Ben Franklin.
You can learn a lot from Ben Franklin. I'll tell you.
Yeah.
You know, this is extremely valuable information. And I'm wondering, are there some key indicators? I know, you know, business jargon is KPIs, you know. Are there any indicators that someone is genuinely finding joy in what they do? Is there anything they can sort of look at to say, you know, according to this scale, I'm finding joy at work?
Well, there are various psychological tests and things like that. But I think a lot simpler thing is to just open a notebook and turn it into a journal and start writing about it. And if you write about what happened today and it was awful, then you write, what are the positive things that happened today? What can I do tomorrow? What's the plan? And if you keep writing about what's happening and your decision of how to make the next day better, your journal becomes your workbook. And there's lots of research about how writing about the tough things in life and then letting them go can be healing. But also that's how you can sometimes connect with your own wisdom. You know a lot more about what will give you joy than anybody else can tell you. And if you force yourself to write about what you're going to do, you have to write something, even if nothing comes to mind immediately, you find it in yourself. If you write every day looking for some way to make tomorrow better, you will always find something.
That is such great advice. We all have those off days. We all have those days where we feel like nothing's going well. And writing things down, specifically with things that you're grateful for, which frankly you can find in something as simple as a nice day, a warm cup of coffee or tea, a bird chirping, all of those things can activate that energy that you're describing. And, you know, the daily ritual of journaling, which is something that I didn't take on for a long, long time because I felt it was just another task. These days, they have apps that you can download. Well, they actually give you daily prompts.
Yeah.
Right? And you can, at the end of the day, they'll say, hey, do you want to just write down a couple of thoughts? And just that, just taking that action of just writing down some things that I'm grateful for the day, some things that happened during that day, and then reviewing those later, you realize that when you're not in the moment, some of the things that were the biggest deals on any particular day don't really mean much at the end of the week. And they kind of put things into perspective, you know?
That's exactly right. There's one other thing that I want to mention in terms of how you can change how you feel about things. the research shows that if you kind of measure emotional change after X, Y, and Z, there are a lot of things you can do to feel better. You can exercise, you can take a break, you can hang out with other people, you can meditate. There's a long list of things like that. But the activity that seems to be most effective in having you feel happier sooner is doing something kind for another person. I think we are hardwired as human beings to need to connect with other people. We're a social animal, and you know, if we're living totally by ourselves, we die. We people have to have other people. But if you commit yourself to doing something kind every day, it focuses you on other things. You forget about all the things you're feeling sorry for yourself about. You think creatively. It opens the creative part of your brain. And then sometimes the person you're kind to is grateful to you and thanks you, and you connect, and it sort of continues an upward spiral. So doing something kind every day is a really good way to start finding more enjoyment.
Absolutely.
Every day.
Absolutely. And it could just be calling someone and talking to them. Maybe there's someone in your life that you just haven't talked to in a while, and they could use a phone call and a kind word or something like that, you know, or even, you know, just in the grocery store checkout line, the person that's back there being genuinely kind and talking to them just will pass along that energy that you're describing. That's really is self-healing. And it's regenerative in such a profound way.
Yeah. And you know, that person in the grocery store, when you're chatting with them, one of the things you're doing is listening.
Right.
Human beings are also hardwired to need to be heard. We need to have other people listen to us. And if you think about so many people, you know, they get up in the morning, you're rushing around, you maybe have to commute again, and you're getting to the workplace. And it feels like we can go a whole day or a whole week and nobody's really listened to us. And if you don't know what else to do, if you're looking for a kind act, is just notice some of the people around you, the grocery store checker or the server in a restaurant or anybody, any person you connect with. If you just ask some questions, how are you doing? You can be giving somebody else something that they really need.
Such great advice. So it all came back to the journalism now. You're with NPR doing a show called Jazzed About Work, which is how we connected. How did that end up coming to be? How did you end up getting back to your roots, so to speak? In a way, I think your show kind of combines almost everything.
Well, no, in a very direct way.
Ah.
Yeah. So the Ohio University has a radio TV station, WOUB. And that's where I worked as a student. And I worked there part-time as a grown-up for a while when I was doing all these other things as a writer. And so I kind of stayed in touch with the university in different ways. And the podcast is actually produced by WOUB, and they're an affiliate of NPR, and that's how it gets to NPR.org. And I can't remember exactly how we started. I've been doing this for 7 years. And I think that WOUB was just starting a podcast program. And somebody said, would you do a few of these for us? We're just kind of trying it out and we need to practice. And, you know, that was 175 podcasts ago. And it turned out to be so much fun. I love it. It's like being in graduate school forever because lots of times I read up on something to prepare for my guests. And a lot of times they've written a book and gosh, when you're on a podcast, you know this, as a podcast host, you're really listening. You really want to be engaged. So I do it as a volunteer for the sheer fun of it. And it's really kind of grown. We have a pretty good following now. And I learn from every single episode.
I will agree with you there. It's absolutely a joy. And you learn so much from these conversations. And you know what's curious is, and I'm interested in your take on this. When you look at podcasts, media in general, things are evolving and changing so much in terms of how people consume media and what, you know, in terms of short form media, long form media. What's your take on how media is evolving?
Wow, it's overwhelming. First, there's so many different channels and platforms and options so that young people today have grown up in an entirely different world, and they're immersed in communications that no other generation in all history has had to juggle. So all of the different kinds of communication are certainly bombarding us. But I've been very active for the last 10 years or so on nonprofit journalism, because the whole business of journalism has been in crisis. We're losing newspapers, like a couple newspapers in this country a week. Across the country, there are all kinds of news deserts where there are whole counties that have no newspaper, no radio, no TV. There's no local news. So nonprofit news, and particularly nonprofit community news, has been in crisis. But at the same time, now all kinds of people are coming forward and they're looking for new models, and they're recognizing how independent, curated, fact-based news is absolutely necessary to civilization. So we see these crises of no news at all, and then we see all kinds of people all over the place, innovative with nonprofit models. And that's happening amidst, you know, so many different kind of opportunities. It's hard to see where things are going to end up, but I'm optimistic because of how many people have now recognized the importance of community journalism and real journalism, are recognizing that it doesn't have to be a newspaper. We have to find a model that's sustainable so that people have a source for good information. And it might be sources that we just can't even imagine yet, but we've got to have that source of good, clear, honest, independent information.
I couldn't agree with you more. You've always found yourself in very unique positions, whether it's at the forefront of feminism and making opportunities for women, whether it's in the nonprofit space, the government space. You've always found yourself in a place where there's excitement happening, there's change happening. And I can see that you love being a catalyst for that change and being a part of that. So your journey is incredibly fascinating. Thank you for walking us through these stories. For my audience, those who are interested in learning more about Beverly Jones, the executive coach, she has a book called Find Your Happy at Work. Her podcast is Jazzed About Work. You can find that on NPR. And she is at Clear Ways Consulting, CLEARWAS consulting.com. We'll also have all of this information down below if you're wherever you are listening or viewing our podcast. Thank you so much, Beverly. Is there anything else that you wanted to cover before we end the show today?
I just want to thank you, Alex. It was lots of fun. And I'm so used to being the host that I always feel a little embarrassed that I've spoken too much. I feel like, oh my gosh, I talk so much. But it was great fun. I really enjoyed it.
I promised you it would be fun. I think I guaranteed it. So if I make a guarantee,
you did.
I aim to fulfill. So thank you so much, Beverly. What an incredible conversation. And I'm looking forward to seeing what's next.